It's time to head out on the front porch on KFRM. Grab your favorite drink, sit back, relax, and enjoy the conversation on the front porch.
Hi, this is Kyle Bauer, your host today on the Front Porch, visiting with Art Harmon. He is a director of the Coalition to Save Manned Space Exploration, and we've had Art on before, back almost a year ago, I think, and we're talking about today why we haven't gone to the moon and why we should go to the moon. Art, let's remind everybody, first of all, about your background, and then we'll talk about the coalition just a bit.
Well, wonderful. And Kyle, great to be back on with you and talking to everybody on KFRM. So thank you very much for having me.
So your background, how is it that you are qualified, I guess, to talk about space travel?
Well, I've been doing space policy since in a serious way since 2010, when I grew up with Apollo, and I was sitting on the floor in our rec room with family as we watched the landing and as we watched the first step, watching on our big old black and white television as many other people of our generation can relate. And so, as a kid, I know, my gosh, this is exciting and enthusiastic. And I'd watched other space launches and missions and, of course, the later ones and the space shuttle. So I always had a strong, that made a great impact on me and always had a strong interest in the space program.
Hey, excuse me, just a second. I'm going to interrupt you. What day did we first walk on the moon? Do you know that?
I think it was, because once they landed, they were ordered, and I don't know if I would have been able to carry out such an order to go to sleep and sleep, because they had probably had no sleep for the last day. And
oh, you're kidding! They sat there a while before they actually walked on the moon.
They did, yeah. Imagine you just landed on the moon. There, you look out the window. There's the moon. And, mission control is saying, okay, go to sleep. We'll do that tomorrow. So I'm not sure, but I think it was probably the 21st. Maybe it was much later on the 20th.
20th of?
Of July. So this is the, just 2 days ago, 3 days ago, was the 49th anniversary, almost half a century.
1969 then.
Amen. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, the thing is I remember one time being at school and they were able to somehow figure out how to hook up a television so that we could see something going on with the space thing in the lunchroom over lunch in Morganville, Kansas. And it was terribly fuzzy, but it obviously wasn't walking on the moon because we wouldn't have had school in July. So I don't remember what we were watching that time. But it was a big thing for everybody growing up.
Yeah, sure. Well, it could have been one of the earlier or later Apollo missions or even Gemini missions. Apollo 8 was December 25th, Christmas Day of 1968, just 7 months before. And that was a really powerful moment as for the first time we went to the moon. We orbited just one loop around it. And that's where that famous picture of what they call Earthrise, with the Earth rising above the surface of the moon, and the crew read from Genesis and so forth. It was a really powerful and emotional moment, and that kind of proved out the concept of going to the moon. And then Apollo 10, they didn't land, but they got in the lunar module and moved it around in space and then came back, and that kind of proved that the lander would operate. And then it was Apollo 11 that that gave us that one giant leap for mankind.
And but you were saying then they were forced to try to go to sleep before they took the walk.
Oh, that would have been so tough for me. You know, I'm the ultimate guy who stays up when I'm traveling. You know, I remember a night train trip from Poland into then the Soviet Union, and I couldn't sleep. I'm peeking out the window, and oh my God, this is Russia! Wow, look at this! Look at those houses go by in the darkness and stuff, and you know, so they would have had to give me sleeping pills or something.
And it really was an exciting time, but then we didn't go back for decades and decades and decades, and there was a lot of people, maybe even me included, going, really? I mean, we did it clear back then with basic, okay, we have the space cosmosphere here in Kansas, in Hutchinson, Kansas. We have space capsules. We have models of the lunar module. And you look at those things, and it looks like they're made, put together with PVC pipe and tinfoil. And it's like, really? If you could go there and come back with that kind of stuff, how come we just don't do it every day? How come after all this amount of time, no other country's ever done it? We've not done it again. Help me with that logic. Help all the people out there like myself that are going, it just doesn't make any sense.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's almost something you want to cry about because it's kind of like a stolen future. Because for us who grew up with it, the excitement, the enthusiasm, doing the impossible. We didn't have the technology in 1961 when JFK said we're going to the moon in a decade, but we're Americans. We invented it. We made it happen. We figured out everything from scratch. Now we've got the technology, you know, as I sometimes quip that, you know, if you take your phone and you drop it in a kitchen blender, each piece you pick out of that blender, so to speak, has got more computing power than the Apollo lander did. So it, you know, we've got materials that are so much stronger and lighter and more, you know, dependable than we did then. But what it really boils down to, it's not even the money. It's the will. It's the political will, the will to say this is a national priority. This will pay off in great spades to our economy, to our high-tech competitiveness in the world, to inspiring Americans to keep up that you know, drive for exploration. What's out there? You know, what's beyond there? You know, I think it was, Edmund Hillary on climbing Mount Everest. I think it was sort of like, well, because it's there. And JFK alluded to that in his speech. You know, why do we choose to go to the moon? You know, why does, Rice University play some other university? And, you know, it's human nature to explore, to learn, to stretch ourselves and do more and more. But there have been efforts. Now, it came down largely to budget in the after Apollo 11, when the decision was made to not just stop or end the Apollo program with everything that was planned, which would have taken us up to Apollo 20, and we had, including a landing in one of the largest craters of the moon that would have been spectacular and geologically, fascinating. But all of the, the folks in Washington were, saying, oh, we want that money. We want to get our hands on that money. And so it became and in fact, I was in one congressional hearing actually much later than that. It was in the year 2000, when a congressman said, "Can you give me one reason this money wouldn't be better spent on welfare?" Well, my gosh, let's just take a look at some of the benefits from the space program. MRIs, you or your mother or your father or whatever have had or might have an MRI. All these medical advances alone that come from doing the impossible and stretching our limits. On the space station now, they're researching bone and muscle loss, because when they're up there, they lose huge amounts of, I think it's like, I forget the numbers, 10% of their bone mass over a month. I think I'm high on that. But, you know, that affects all of us down here as we age. And so for those, you know, in retirement age, those who are will be retired one day, the advances that we got from the space program can come down to benefit everyone. So to answer that congressman's question, yeah, better than giving the money away in welfare is to keep investing it in stretching the, you know, pushing the envelope, stretching our medical and scientific knowledge.
We're visiting with Art Harmon. He is the director of the Coalition to Save Manned Space Exploration. You're listening to On the Front Porch. Join us more after this break. Welcome back to more On the Front Porch. We're visiting with Art Harmon. He's the director of the Coalition to Save Manned Space Exploration. And before we went to the break, we talked about why we haven't gone back to the moon since the early 70s, late 60s, and there was plans to go many, many more missions. Basically, the money disappeared. But Art, how many people right now, how many countries right now that have a space program? 6, 8, 9?
Yeah, in varying ways, it's about that. The biggies are, of course, the U.S., Russia, China, Japan, collectively the EU nations through the European Space Agency. And then there's some upcoming ones. India is got great vision for advancing. They sent an orbiter to Mars about a year, 2 years ago. And then you've got unlikely countries like UAE, United Arab Emirates, South Korea. They're looking to advance their space program, as well as possibly Saudi Arabia. So there's a great, as the technology has matured and therefore prices of launches come down, thanks to folks like SpaceX with their reusable rockets and at some point, Blue Origin, then, you know, the cost will be and risk will be coming down, so that more and more countries can afford both national space programs and as well as many, many commercial space ventures.
But if there's all these different countries that have the capabilities of going to space, if it was something that was important to go to the moon, wouldn't one of them over the last 40 years have gone and done it?
Yeah, again, this is something you almost want to cry about, because we could have. We, you know, the U.S. itself, actually, Wernher von Braun, who was in many ways sort of the technological, doer of our Apollo program, making it happen. He had a whole plan sketched out that would have in the 1970s put a permanent manned base on the moon. And in the 1980s, 30 years ago, would have put footprints on Mars. So we kind of gave up. Other countries simply did not have the technology to duplicate it, nor the money. The Soviets and then the Russians, right now, they're having great problems affording what they do in civilian space. China is the big upstart. China, 10 years ago, couldn't put a person in orbit. Now they've put several people in orbit, and they've got huge plans, including building a base, not just landing on the moon, but building a base on the moon in the mid-2020s.
Is their ultimate reason for doing that? Research, or do they have a disclosed reason for that project?
Well, you've got to understand China, and I spent a lot of time studying the Chinese space program because it is run by the Chinese military. It is not a civilian space program at all. And if you have to look at their actions on Earth and their stated intentions in space, and those are domination and conquest. If you look at the South China Sea, where they're violating 400 years of freedom of the seas and invading sovereign territories of many nations by claiming that falsely that the South China Sea is their property, then they're going to operate the same way in space. And already they're talking about vertical sovereignty, and that means everything stretching out as far as the eye can see from China is their property, meaning orbit, meaning where satellites are. And, because China does not recognize the sovereignty of other nations. They only recognize the sovereignty of themselves. That's their military strategy and posture. And so they will plan to conquer the moon unless we go back as well. So that's why it's imperative that we use the next 10 years to actually put boots on the moon again, build a base, and then use that to learn how to live on Mars, perfect it on the moon where it's close and convenient, and then we'll be ready for that first dusty red footprint on Mars.
Now, help me just a little bit. In the last month or so, President Trump made some, probably just a Twitter statement, but some statement about space and, he made a new space agency, right? A whole new department. Can you explain that to us?
Yes, of course. The Space Force, which has created both strategic interest, but also a lot of Star Wars bravado-like comments on Facebook, like I'm joining the Space Force and repel the alien invaders. But what it really is this is, China and Russia have very serious anti-satellite capabilities, and in a time of war, they could take out many of the satellites that we rely upon, GPS, military communication satellites, and so forth. And so the Space Force is a way to consolidate our space defense activities into one branch of the armed forces. Now, we're not going to have X-wing fighters patrolling the moon, but mostly it's going to be done out of rather boring-looking buildings with dozens and hundreds of people behind computer monitors dealing with cyber threats, through space, protecting our space assets, things like that. But it's a valuable thing from a strategic aspect. Because the Chinese do intend in any conflict they start to dominate, not just on Earth, South China Sea, Taiwan, anywhere they want to take over, but also the high frontier space and deny our use of it to defend ourselves and for commerce.
Now, as I recall, when the president made that announcement, there was a number of people that said that if he were to do that, that is in violation of treaties that we have with other countries around the world. Do you recall that statement?
Yeah, that was just ridiculous. All it's doing is putting into one agency a lot of things that have been done for decades, which is planning for and carrying out the operational needs of defending our assets in space, our satellites, our access to orbit and beyond. So it's not like we're going to be flying fighters through space and bombing China and Iran from Earth from space. But it does mean that we'll have a little bit better way to organize and command those assets we have now and need for the future to protect our satellites, to protect our access to space, to stop enemy missile attacks on the U.S., whether from rogue states like Iran and North Korea or China and Russia.
Now, after do I hear you say then between the lines that we do have mechanisms, mechanics, technology to defend our satellites now?
I think it's in the early stages. Most satellites are just plain dumb satellites. They just sit there. They don't have cameras on them to watch out what's incoming and so forth. But it's known that China and perhaps Russia will take their anti-satellite satellites and place them kind of nearby our key satellites, so that they can then, whenever the time comes, push a button and blow up our satellites. And how do you respond to that? Just kind of like, it'd be like having somebody roll up a howitzer to your front yard, aim it at your house, and just stand there waiting for the day their masters say, fire it. You wouldn't like it. So we have to have those strategies. Now, it doesn't violate any treaties to be able to defend ourselves. Offensive warfare may be another matter. That's what the Chinese and Russians are doing planning for. We plan for, defending our assets, our access, and so forth. Different.
You're listening to Art Harmon. He's the director of the Coalition to Save Manned Space Exploration. We're picking his brain today on everything about space that I don't know, you don't know, and that we as the general public probably haven't taken the time to study. So join us after this break, and we're going to find out more about space and manned space travel. Welcome back to On the Front Porch. We're talking space travel. I'm 60 years old, and a lot of the time that we went on the moon and to the moon was during my growing up years. It's kind of hard for me to keep it all straight. Of course, we all remember Apollo 13 and the heroics, and of course, there was a movie made out of it and the different tragedies along the way, but it all kind of mixes together, even for those of us who lived through it, as to what happened. We're visiting today with Art Harmon. He is the director of Coalition to Save Manned Space Exploration. And Art, help me with, okay, what was the first mission that went to the moon that actually put men on the surface of the moon, and how many went, and what did each of them do, and how many years did that span?
Sure, happily. And Kyle, it's a great pleasure being with you on the front porch and reaching out to everyone on KFRM. So glad to be back with you. And for people who want to learn more, you can go to my website, savemannedspace.com. SaveManSpace.com, and I'm on Facebook and Twitter at the same SaveManSpace. So let's hit the rewind button back to 1969, July. July 20th, we had the very first landing on the moon, takeoff from Kennedy Space Center, and millions of people. You know, look at old photos, and you'll see there were literally millions of people lined up all around the Space Center and the beaches up and down the coast to watch our men go to the moon. And I never witnessed an Apollo launch. I would have loved to have. I managed to witness many launches of space shuttle and other rockets, but the thunder and shaking and so forth of an Apollo rocket was something to behold. So they took off, and it took about 3 days, 3.5 days to get to the moon. So they're in a capsule, about the size of a compact car. And they're basically stuck in their seats for the entire duration. There's plumbing in their spacesuits to do what plumbing needs there are. And they've got their helmets off and so forth during it so they can eat sort of normally. But that's the trip. So you want to be really good friends with the person sitting, just like flying economy on an airplane. You want to be really good friends with the person sitting next to you. And so they had their journey and watching Earth diminish and then watching the moon get bigger and bigger and bigger. And then they went into lunar orbit. And then this is where they had a little parting of the ways, because Michael Collins was the one who had to stay in the command module, in the space capsule, as Buzz Aldrin and Neil Armstrong got in the lunar lander and descended to the surface. So they descended, and this was a harrowing ride, because they had mapped it out, done all the calculations, and the lander with its little teeny computer brain that couldn't run even a flip phone today performed flawlessly and got them down to near landing. I had a really emotional moment for me. I had the honor of meeting Neil Armstrong some years ago, in his last testimony to the U.S. Congress. And he did a narrated landing. So they projected up on the screen the camera that was looking out the window showing the moon below as it got closer and closer. So Neil Armstrong was going over what was going through his mind at the time, because there's a sort of a slogan, almost a rule in aviation, aviate, navigate, communicate. So you don't communicate when you're doing something stressful. You just work to save that airplane, whatever. You don't worry about where it's going. You just want to get it back to straight and level. So he wasn't talking, and as will come evident in my description a few moments later. So, but what he sees is he's there coming down to a field of boulders, which would have destroyed the spacecraft. So he takes over from the autopilot, and all the meanwhile, the alarm bells are going off for low fuel, and you can watch this on YouTube and so forth. And they're counting down from Houston ground control. They're counting down sort of the amount of fuel remaining, and so forth. And Neil's just flying the spacecraft, trying to find a clear place to land. And he finally finds a place, and he lands just as the fuel is just about ready to go out. And this is why Neil Armstrong became the commander, because he was calm under pressure. One example, when he was practicing landing the lunar lander on Earth, they had this really bizarre, look it up on YouTube, a little craft that looked like a spider with a giant jet engine in the middle of it. And so it was simulating the gravity and everything of landing on the moon. So he's practicing in this lunar landings, get the feel of it, you know, just like you use aircraft simulators to learn how to fly a plane. And the thing goes berserk. He ejects, they say, 1 second before he would have been killed, where the whole thing blew up and crashed. So, but he ejects. He comes down and he lands and so forth. What does he do? He goes back to his office and starts to work. And someone comes up to him and says, Neil, you were almost killed. What are you doing at work? And he says, well, I had work to do. And that's what we needed, you know, the real right stuff in order to make that first landing on the moon where we didn't know what the hell we were really getting into. And so they bring down the spacecraft, land it successfully, and those words will echo throughout history. You know, Houston, a little emotional even talking about it. You know, Houston, Eagle has landed. And then Houston replies back, something like, thank God, and you had a bunch of boys here turning blue. Well, why was that? Because Neil was too busy flying the spacecraft to tell him what he was doing, escaping the boulders and finding a safe flat place to land. So they didn't know what was going on.
They didn't
on.
Know that he didn't blow up.
Exactly. And so at that point, you know, cheers and applause break out in the control room. And on probably about a billion people around the planet, the landing was, and the walks were probably until only fairly recent times, the most ever watched TV program in history. As we're mentioning before the show, once they landed and they did all their post-flight checkouts, make sure everything's operating and so forth and safe, guess what they had to do? Go to sleep. Now, I'm the guy who can't sleep on, you know, overnight airplane flights. You know, usually I'm glued to the window looking at the aurora or the clouds from the moon or the constellations and so forth. And just too excited to go to sleep, even on a really long flight. And so I would have had a darn tough time carrying out that order. So, okay, you just landed on the moon. Let's go to sleep.
Well, we only have a minute before the break, so I don't know where to take us here, except that, okay, they are now going to, they've taken their sleep, and they're going to step down on the moon. Their first mission, what were they expected to accomplish on their first mission? Just see if when they touched, they didn't fall in a hole, or it had to be relatively simple. And again, you got 30 seconds to tell us.
It was to collect some samples of the moon. It was to demonstrate we could do it. It was to remain safe. And yes, it was to fly the flag and show that America had done the greatest feat in the history of mankind.
Well, you're listening to Art Harmon. He is the director for the Coalition to Save Manned Space Exploration. We have one more segment of On the Front Porch, so join us after this. We'll hear about some more details after they've made their walk on the moon and how in the heck they got home. Join us more after this. Welcome back to the final segment of On the Front Porch, visiting once again today with Art Harmon. He's the director of the Coalition to Save Manned Space Exploration, and we're talking about the Apollo mission that first walked on the moon. happened July the 20th, 1969, or maybe July the 21st, because they made him go to sleep before they'd let him walk on the moon. Before we went to the break, Art, they had a mission, basically plant the flag, grab a few rocks. Now, they had to get home. You got a space capsule going, circling the moon at several thousand miles an hour. You've got a little tin foil jet pack down here on the moon, and those two have to find each other in space, and it isn't like they had the computing power that they do today. What happens next? How in the world do they find each other?
All right, and once again, glad to take you all listening from the front porch to the surface of the moon, and delighted to be with you, Kyle, on KFRM. This was less of an issue than you might imagine, because folks on the ground knew where both the lunar module and the orbiting capsule were at any minute. So they would steer them up, and they would probably when it's kind of almost like an autopilot on an airplane, even of the sorts that they had back in the 1960s, to compute the position, you know, because Houston will say, okay, the lunar module is at this position, I mean, the orbiter is at this point, so then the minor computing power of the lander would then help compute that orbit with the help of ground control. So refinding it, even though you can imagine something, you know, the lunar capsule is, I don't know, maybe it was 20 feet in diameter. I'm sorry, the Apollo capsule. And so you're going to find something like that in the middle of absolutely nowhere. But it was easier than we think, because folks back on the ground were tracking it. But then docking, redocking, you have to dock these two spacecraft together and then transfer to the capsule and transfer all of the rocks, the precious rocks that still today are the only samples of the moon that we have on Earth.
You know, I think, though, that a lot of us, it's been so long since we've taken physics, basically, once you start something in a straight line in space, it keeps going in that space or in that line. But to think about that capsule circling the moon and the lunar module has to match up to the same speed, because when they're going to hook up, they can't be plus or minus 20, 30 miles an hour.
Oh, indeed. You're exactly right. And something less catastrophic than that almost destroyed the Russian Mir station when there was a hard docking that caused it to tumble. But that was, you know, the big computers, the giant computers the size of warehouses that NASA had at the time, that would have done the heavy computing. They would have then fed the numbers to the lunar module. And then it would go up and probably take a couple of orbits to match speed and high altitude and so forth. And then as they approach, they get slower and slower and slower. So it's by firing their retro rockets. So when they actually touch, you know, it's probably, you know, in the order of a quarter of a mile an hour or something. And so there would just be a little slight jar. But they actually would be able to, both with radar and visual sightings, once they spot it, they would slow down and then use manual controls to jockey both into the exact position.
So once they're hooked back together and all three men are back in the space capsule, is the lunar module then jettisoned at that point?
Exactly, and they toss their, you know, a lot of things like spacesuits and trash into the lunar module and sent that packing, so they had the weight of those didn't unduly burden them on the for bringing back a lot of moon rocks. And we learned something because we deliberately crashed it, like at high speed, into the moon while devices that we left on the moon, as well as, observations of the moon, we were able to get sort of a seismological reading of the moon because we created a very micro earthquake, moonquake. And so we were able to get a little bit more data about, you know, the density of the moon itself. And we did that with successive moon missions.
So after they are all back on the capsule, then is it as simple as shooting a couple thrusters and headed toward home?
Yeah, pretty much. And again, the big computer is on in Houston and so forth. We'll be doing the heavy lifting on that, but it's a pretty simple computation. And I'm sure they knew it kind of by heart, you know, how to do it. And some of it was probably already pre-programmed. And so then it was the 3-day or so return, at which point then they go into orbit around the Earth and they land. They're picked up by an aircraft carrier. And one of the interesting little oddities was they didn't, you know, immediately come back and have a ticker tape parade. They were kept in a in an Airstream trailer that was like sealed off from Earth with its own oxygen and life support for like 2 weeks, just to make absolutely sure there weren't any moon organisms that could affect us. And only after that, then nobody got sick and turned green and sprouted antenna, that they were released, and then they had the ticker tape parade down through Times Square, and kind of the rest is history, which was then repeated 5 more times on successive moon landings.
You know, as I'm thinking about all these things as you're talking about them, and again, I don't recall where I was, but I remember watching things, and this might not have been Apollo. Maybe it was one of the other just manned space travels, Gemini. But when when they opened that capsule, and as I recall, they knew fairly well where they were going to drop that capsule in, and like you said, there was an aircraft carrier there, and then they would deploy helicopters out. But then that capsule was just floating, if you will, in the ocean. And I don't remember who pops that capsule open, whether it's the astronaut that does it or it's the divers that do it. But I remember seeing the astronaut or astronauts wave. Did I make that up?
No. That would have been a very common thing with them all. They splash down. The divers go out. I don't know whether it was opened internally or externally, but they then get out and are put into a cargo net and hoisted up, and then a separate team grabs and recovers the capsule.
You know, that's a big ocean out there. It's pretty amazing that they could drop it close enough to be able to pick it up fairly quickly. Did it always happen that way?
Yeah, I'm not aware of any that they had to, you know, go to long lengths. They were, you know, because when it's reentering, you've got half an hour or more when it's reentering, where you'll know exactly, you know, within a mile or two where it's going to hit. That's pretty easy to do, so then you've got plenty of time. If it's going to be a mile west, you just sail your boat that way and just make sure you're far enough away from it that it's not going to hit your ship, and so that's pretty easy. You know what? We're going to be doing our first Orion and Boeing and SpaceX landings the same way. Basically, eventually they'll be will be landing on ground, which will help make reusability better. But both Boeing and SpaceX are building manned capsules that maybe not could be used for lunar landings, you know, lunar missions and Mars missions. They would have to upgrade them a lot, and then we're building the Orion capsule, which is a bit bigger and designed specifically for lunar and Mars missions.
Well, so, Art, we're out of time. We're out of time, and I want you to be able to plug your how they get a hold of you. Art Harmon, Director of Coalition to Save Manned Space Exploration. And, Art, if they want to follow you more, how would you suggest doing that?
Well, what a pleasure, Kyle. SaveManspace.com, Save Manned, M-A-N-N-E-D, space, .com, and Save Manned Space on Facebook and Twitter as well. Follow along, reach out with any questions, and delighted to be on with you today and sharing the adventures of 49 years ago when mankind did its most incredible feat ever.
Welcome to Ag Perspectives. I'm Jim Winker. Today we'll learn more about a decision from the EPA on Friday to allow E15 to continue to be sold this summer. In the first part of Ag Perspectives, we'll hear from the Renewable Fuels Association Senior Vice President for Government and Public Affairs, Troy Bredenkamp. And in the second half of our program, we'll hear more from the RFA's Chief Economist, Scott Richman.
We had very welcome news from the EPA. They have issued the emergency waiver for E15 for this coming summer driving season. E15 is not available for sale usually because of a vapor pressure issue during June 1st to September 15th. The last 5 or 6 years, we have been able to maintain some year-round sale of E15, mostly through emergency waivers. And the Biden administration looked at the criteria that needed to be met and realized that there are issues going on all over the world. Geopolitical unrest continues in Europe. There's obviously situations that are developing in the Middle East, and all of that could lead to a supply issue over this summer. And so they felt that they needed to get a little bit ahead of that, and they issued emergency waivers that would allow for summertime sale of E15 for this summer driving season. So very good news, not only for consumers, because they're going to have access to the lowest cost fuel at the pump, but it's also a good news story because E15 is cleaner burning and all those other things. And it won't disrupt the supply chain by actually having those E15 blends not available this summer. So very much welcome news. Of course, the ultimate goal here, though, is to find a permanent solution to this. While we certainly appreciate the Biden administration's issuance of the summertime waiver, we are certainly seeking some sort of permanent legislative solution that will help resolve this issue long-term for E15 so that we don't have to keep begging and pleading to make sure that E15 does not disappear during the summer. The 8 Midwest states that petitioned the EPA to opt out of the RVP program were granted that, but it was delayed until 2025. And so those 8 states were certainly in need of some kind of an emergency waiver to get through this summer driving season, but also the other 42 states, you know, would not have had access to E15 if there was any being sold within those states. And some of those, you start looking outside of that 8 state area, there's some significant E15 sales going on. And so ironically, we would have probably needed an emergency waiver for the other 42 states, even if those 8 Midwest states had been given this RVP opt-out and it had it been effective this summer driving season. So there's just a lot of balls in the air. Again, this all points to the need for permanent legislative resolution to this issue. It's there in a bill that's been introduced not only in the Senate, in S-2707, but we're also working to get a bill introduced in the House so that we can permanently and in a forever way, you know, resolve this issue so that consumers have certainty, the industry would have certainty, retailers that are looking to adopt E15 and to install the infrastructure needed to utilize E15, they would have certainty. All of that is what's required, and the federal legislation is what would make that happen. We've been working very closely with the American Petroleum Institute, which is the largest trade organization for oil and gas companies and refineries. They realize that 8-state opt-out is not ideal for them. I think they understand why it was what was asked for by those 8 states. It would require a different base fuel, a lower volatilization fuel to be utilized and be brought into those states during the summer. So again, if you had harmonization across the country by having year-round E15 resolved, then that would be a far better solution and a far better position for our supply chain, so that there isn't disruption or there's no bottlenecks or anything like that. So yes, that's again speaking to the need for a federal legislative fix. So we continue to push to make sure that the legislative solution to E15, which is S2707, the Nationwide Consumer and Fuel Retailer Choice Act, is adopted by Congress as soon as possible. We have run into a little bit of a roadblock in Senator Carper of Delaware. He is chairman of the Senate Environment and Public Works Committee. He has a refinery in his state that is not supportive of getting year-round E15 resolved. And so he has made it clear to us that until that refiner is satisfied with whatever compromise language we might come up with, that he's not going to support it. So that's where we're at. We're trying to work ways around that issue with him. We're trying to make sure that Midwest Democrat colleagues of his are weighing in and are expressing to him the need to get this permanent solution passed and resolved.